It's On Health. I'm Allison Aubrey, reporting from the NPR rooftop, where it's really sunny. I'll tell you why I'm here in just a moment. But first, have you heard conflicting information about the H1N1 virus? We'll bring you up to date on the development of a vaccine and the challenges of administering it. First, the sunshine vitamin. We hear a lot about the benefits of vitamin D, which brings me back to why I'm here on the rooftop. I've got Professor Michael Hollick on the line. He directs the Bone Healthcare Clinic at the Boston University Medical Center, and he's been a researcher in vitamin D for many years. Hi there, Professor Hollick.
Hello, how you doing? I'm envious that you're up on the roof.
So let me ask you, it's really sunny, as I've described. It's about midday, midsummer. How long would I need to stay up here to get all the vitamin D that I need?
Yeah, I would typically recommend, especially for a light-skinned person, that probably about maybe 5 to 10 minutes of arms and legs three times a week is often more than adequate to satisfy your requirement, and then to put good sun protection on to prevent the damaging effects from excessive exposure.
You know what? I'm headed right back down to the studio because I've already been up here for 5 or 10 minutes, so let's do the rest of the interview from the studio.
No problem. That's great.
All right. Thanks so much. Hold on just a moment. So here I am. I'm back in the studio, and I have a thought. It leads me to this question of, if we only need 5 or 10 minutes a day, why are so many of us deficient? I look around. It seems like everyone's getting 5 or 10 minutes of sunlight in, but the prevalence studies show that a lot of Americans are vitamin D deficient. Is that right?
That's correct. It's estimated that more than 50% of both children and adults in the United States are at risk of vitamin D deficiency. And you're correct that if you are getting about 5 to 10 minutes of sun exposure of arms and legs between the hours of 10 a.m. and 3 p.m., about 3 to 4 times a week in the spring, summer, and fall, you're not likely to be vitamin D deficient. But there are very few people that do that.
Now let's get to why we need this. Explain the relationship between vitamin D and calcium.
Well, it's always well documented that children are needing an adequate amount of vitamin D and calcium for healthy bones. And in fact, rickets, of course, was a very common problem until vitamin D was introduced into milk and to other foods that were fortified. But we're now realizing that that really is the bare minimum that you need for skeletal health for children, and that all adults also need vitamin D, and that we're recognizing that every tissue and cell in your body requires vitamin D to maximize your overall health and well-being. And that's why vitamin D deficiency has been associated with increased risk of autoimmune diseases like type 1 diabetes, multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, puts you at increased risk of having a heart attack, having a stroke, increases risk of having infections, including influenza, and also increases risk of developing deadly cancers, colon, prostate, breast, by as much as 50%.
I'm wondering, given all this gathering evidence, why it is that we are not being advised to take in more vitamin D. I guess the recommendations now are at 200 international units, but there are lots of researchers, including yourself, if I'm accurate about this, that have been saying we need to be suggesting something like 1,000 international units a day.
You're correct. The major reason is that physicians have been concerned about vitamin D toxicity, and in fact, physicians have always been taught to be wary of vitamin D because of toxicity. What they didn't appreciate was that you really have to take huge amounts of vitamin D before you're going to become intoxicated. The Institute of Medicine has now convened a panel, and on August 4th, there's going to be a meeting of that panel with experts, including myself, giving expert testimony to them, and we anticipate by next year, sometime in the spring, that they're going to come out with new recommendations. And I suspect that they will be markedly increased in terms of what the recommendations should be.
Increasingly, we hear that argument that we should just be getting our nutrients through our diet, eating a healthy diet, as opposed to taking nutritional supplements. Would that also be the case with vitamin D? If you're eating well, getting a little sunlight, might you not need a vitamin D supplement?
Unfortunately, no. And that's the problem. There's essentially no food that naturally contains vitamin D. That food is principally oily fish like salmon, mackerel, herring. They only contain about 500 to 1,000 units in a serving. If you like cod liver oil, it's an okay source of vitamin D. Some foods are fortified with vitamin D, but 100 international units in a serving. We think that most children need at least 1,000 to 1,500 international units a day, adults need 1,500 to 2,000 international units a day. You cannot get enough vitamin D from your diet.
What gets in the way of absorbing vitamin D? If you are, as you say, getting it from the sun, you're not getting it from your diet, how come some of us can get a little sun and have adequate stores of vitamin D and others don't?
There are two major causes for decreasing the efficiency of vitamin D production and utilization in the skin. The first is that if you have increase in skin pigmentation, so for example, an African American that has what we consider to be a skin type 4 or 5, so that they basically can be out in the sun and never burn and always get darker, that they need to be outside for 5 to 10 times longer to make the same amount of vitamin D, because they're walking around with a sunscreen protection factor of about 15, reducing their ability to make vitamin D in their skin by about 90%. Obese people that are exposed to sunlight only utilize about 50% of that vitamin D, because 50% of it winds up in their body fat and they can't get back out. 50% will finally get into the bloodstream that can be used. And as a result, they need to get twice as much vitamin D either from supplements or from sun exposure.
And what about age? How does age affect absorption of vitamin D?
Yeah, aging will decrease the ability of the skin to make vitamin D. We've done studies and showed that a 20-year-old makes about 3 times more vitamin D than an older person about the age of 70. But the skin has such a huge capacity to make vitamin D that even elders can make an adequate amount of vitamin D in their skin if they expose their arms and legs a couple of times a week for about, like I said, about 10 to 15 minutes of sensible sun exposure between the hours of about 10 a.m. and 3 p.m., spring, summer, and fall.
So how has your research influenced your own personal behaviors? Do you get a lot of sunshine? Do you take a vitamin D supplement?
I take 2,000-unit supplement. I drink 3 glasses of milk a day, which is about 300 units. I take a multivitamin that contains 400 units. And so my average intake is about 2,700 units a day. I also love to play tennis, wear sunscreen on face, not on arms and legs. I also love to cycle on the weekends, again, sunscreen on face, not on arms and legs. My blood level of 25-hydroxy vitamin D, which is what your listeners should ask their doctor to measure if they want to know what their vitamin D status is around 50 to 60 nanograms per ml. We'd like for people to be between 30, which is the lowest, and up to 100 is perfectly safe.
Let me ask you this. Have you ever gotten into it with a dermatologist? I mean, either professionally or just personally, any dermatologist that you may know? I know that dermatologists' message often is, you know, really limit the UV exposure and always wear sunscreen.
Well, the American Academy of Dermatology just came out again with the recommendation that you can get your vitamin D from diet and from supplements, and that there is no need to ever be exposed to unprotected sun. In Australia, however, believe it or not, the slip, slap, slop message, they did a study in dermatologists at the end of the summer. 87% were vitamin D deficient. They now recognize that about 30 to 50% of the Australian population is vitamin D deficient because of this warning about any direct sun exposure. So finally, even the Dermatology Society in Australia and the Cancer Society in Australia have come out with a recommendation of some sensible sun exposure. Get some for adequate vitamin D, but don't get too much to increase risk of skin cancer.
So still an active debate there among vitamin D researchers like yourself, who are proponents of using more, and dermatologists who are a little skeptical.
Well, the dermatologists have been originally skeptical of the message that vitamin D was important for health and reducing risk of chronic diseases. They are finally getting that message, and in fact, even the American Academy of Dermatology is beginning to recommend 1,000 international units supplement a day, which I think is great. The problem is that it's unrealistic to get every child and adult to be taking a supplement every day. Sunlight is for free, and if you can take advantage of its beneficial effect, it's a wonderful source for vitamin D. Now, I'll give you a perspective. If you are in a bathing suit, so you're exposing basically some abdomen, back, your arms and legs, and you're out on Cape Cod for about 15 to 20 minutes, so you get what we consider to be a light pinkness to your skin 24 hours later. It's a minimal erythemal dose. It's equivalent to taking a 10,000 to 20,000 units of vitamin D. So your skin
wow.
has a huge capacity to make vitamin D.
Wow, that's a little exposure for a lot of vitamin D. And let me ask you this. We're in the middle of summer now, so if we're out and about outside, we're getting sufficient vitamin D, as you've just described. What happens when October, November roll around? How long does it take for us to deplete our stores of vitamin D?
That's an excellent question. Mother Nature had designed the system early in evolution so that you would make enough vitamin D in your skin to build up body stores in your body fat, and you would release it during the winter time, so you would never be vitamin D deficient. However, we know that if you're only barely vitamin D deficient, then you will deplete those stores within about 1 month. And so people will become severely vitamin D deficient by the end of the winter. We did a study in healthy adults in Boston last year. We gave them 1,000 international units of vitamin D a day. Not one person raised their blood level above 30 nanograms per ml. They were all vitamin D deficient or insufficient, and 1,000 units a day was inadequate in making them vitamin D sufficient.
So without the sunshine, the supplementation just wasn't enough.
Well, you need to get more supplementation. And like I said, about 2,000 units of vitamin D a day for adults should bring them up into a healthy level. But sensible sun exposure really will help build up your body's stores of vitamin D that you can use during the winter.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Michael Pollack directs the Bone Healthcare Clinic at the Boston University Medical Center. Well, if you're in summer mode, busy getting lots of vitamin D at the beach or pool, you may have missed the recent announcement from the World Health Organization giving drug makers the full go-ahead to manufacture vaccines against the pandemic influenza strain H1N1. Officials say since this virus is unstoppable, countries need to first think about vaccinating healthcare workers. Our colleague Dick Knox took a look at how the vaccine development is going here in this country and the snags they've hit so far. You can give a listen at NPR.org. Now, to help understand what it would take to actually vaccinate scores of people, children, and communities really quickly, we phoned Dr. William Schaffner. He chairs the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University, and he knows a heck of a lot about preventing the spread of infectious diseases. Hi there, Dr. Schaffner.
Hello, Allison.
So let's start with a basic question. I know that H1N1 in the span of just a few months has gone from this scary new virus to something that thousands of people have gotten and thousands of people have recovered from. So for people who may be asking, what's the big deal here? Do we really need a vaccine? What can you say to them?
The vaccine prevents hospitalizations, pneumonia, and death.
And, of course, this is very similar to what we see each year with the regular flu. Is that right?
It certainly is. There's been a little bit of a myth that this is a very mild infection. But like regular influenza, it can put you into the hospital and into the intensive care unit, and it can kill you. Young children have been in intensive care units in 24 hours. Young adults have been hospitalized with very serious illness with regular influenza and with this H1N1 virus. We need to vaccinate to prevent those illnesses.
We actually sent our intern, Gwyneth Dickey, out to the National Mall here in Washington, where there are lots of tourists this time of year, to kind of gauge their concern or their interest in this swine flu and the attempt to vaccinate people. We heard from Kenyetta Nelson from Hyattsville, Maryland.
How did they come up with this vaccine? And, like, what is in the vaccine they're giving to the kids?
This vaccine is made exactly the way our regular annual influenza vaccine is made. We take the virus that's circulating, we tame it, and then it's manufactured. The virus is killed. Its subparticles are then put together and made safe in either an inoculation or a nasal spray form.
So we also had a question from Erica Kohler.
The cost-benefit analysis of a shot, I mean, what are the repercussions? What are the impacts of the shot? Is it anything that I would need to be concerned about long-term health effects? Is the vaccination effective even? I guess always when a parent gets a shot for their child, they have to weigh the benefits versus the concerns that you might have over the shot.
Well, as far as cost-benefit analysis is concerned, we try to prevent as much influenza each year because of all the hospitalizations and the deaths that occur, and we've long ago decided that this is a very cost-beneficial thing to do. As to her individual pocketbook, Ms. Kohler, I think, won't have to worry because we as taxpayers have already paid for this vaccine that's coming up. Long-term, that's another interest or question about vaccine safety. We anticipate, just as with the regular influenza vaccine, there will be no long-term adverse effects.
And historically speaking, when is the last time that we've gotten sort of a new vaccination, an effort to vaccinate a whole community, a whole group of people, or perhaps the whole nation from a new virus? When's the last time we've taken this on as a country?
Well, the last huge campaign like this, done in a short period of time, of course, was back in 76 with the swine influenza vaccination campaign. But since then, we've introduced new influenza vaccines each year and many other vaccines that are used universally in children in the United States. So we're adept at introducing new vaccines and monitoring them for safety and effectiveness.
Now, you're in discussions with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that's calling a special meeting later this month to decide whether and who we should vaccinate. What goes into these discussions? I mean, it's quite complicated to try to vaccinate whole communities, right?
Oh, this is going to be a very complicated season. Hold on. Tighten your seatbelt. First of all, we'll have a regular influenza vaccine. That will be available in abundance starting in September, early in September, and I urge everyone to get vaccinated with the regular vaccine right away because those strains will be active also. Then it is likely we will have a vaccine against this new H1N1 virus available sometime in mid-October. I don't know how optimistic we can be, but the supplies should start coming in. There won't be enough for everyone at time zero. More shipments will come in due course. So we'll have to decide who goes first. And mostly we've decided healthcare workers should get immunized first. After all, we have to provide healthcare, and we don't want to give our influenza to our patients. But after that, who goes next?
So there would likely be two shots here from what you've just described. You'd have to get the regular flu vaccine and then sort of come back later in the season. Is that right?
Actually, that's almost right. There'll be the regular vaccine and then the new one. And the new one itself, because it's so new and the body hasn't encountered this virus before, it itself may need, get this, two shots.
Ah, so now we're talking three shots in a season.
Yes, we are.
And that might be complicated. Yeah.
Yes.
Talk about what it would take to get this vaccine administered, say, in a school setting, where we just talked about the idea that we'd have to have at least two shots.
Well, I've got a headache.
That's all complicated, huh?
Think of all the children who need two inoculations. I'm sure we're going to enlist our colleagues in pediatrics, and some of the vaccine, I am sure, also will be given in public health departments. But since school-age children are involved, there has been the thought of trying to do it in the school setting. After all, they're all together there, right? That should make it easy. Except that schools don't have the resources to do that. The health department and others, often volunteers, have to come in to do that. And you have to organize it. You have to get all those permission slips. And it turns out to be a very elaborate enterprise, and it's much more complicated than it first sounds.
I was going to say, this school nurse at my children's school is overwhelmed with checking for lice and helping children get their fallen teeth, their baby teeth out, and those kinds of things. So adding something that would require administering a shot is quite complicated.
And not only one, we've got to do it twice. So it gets very complicated, and congratulations on having a school nurse in your child's school. There are some school nurses these days that cover several schools.
And what should we be watching out for in terms of a timeline? When might we know what kind of plan is going to unfold?
This is going to be an evolving plan, so we must all be alert. First, we'll hear an exhortation or an announcement that it's important to get our regular influenza vaccine, and then, probably into October, that this H1N1 influenza vaccine is coming, and who should go first and who should come next, and where to go to get the vaccine.
Well, thank you so much, Bill, for joining us.
Sure. A pleasure.
All right. William Schaffner chairs the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University. That's all for this edition of On Health. Listen again next week, where we will deconstruct the world of antioxidants and flavonoids, all those micronutrients in your food that are supposed to be good for you. Thanks for listening. If you'd like us to investigate any other health issues, please write to us and let us know at nprhealth@npr.org. I'm Alice Naubrey, and I'd like to give a special thanks to Gwyneth Dickey this week, who helped us out in the field. Have a great week.